Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Apuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper Sunday, August 12th, 2018, coming to you directly from Bogota, Colombia. This is the Bogota edition.
That's right.
And with us today are special guests, Granger Apuhoff and Nico Jazzbon.
That's right. We're going to start with a segment that's going to be recorded on location in Bogota, Colombia, before we get to our regular content. And We have come to Colombia
to check out what these two are up to.
And what they're up to is turns out to be quite a bit. They're in business, and they mean business. And we're here to sort of see what they're doing. And I'll tell you, one of the big rewards from the trip has been, not to cut to the chase, but we're coming home with sweatshirts. We're coming home with swag. And the sweatshirts say on it, what do they say on it, Granger?
Say Bogota Dev, Bootcamp and Dev Shop. And that's our business. We have a dev shop that makes software for hire. And we have a bootcamp that teaches people how to do web development and programming.
That's right.
Here in Bogota.
Here in Bogota.
You've been operating since?
February.
February 2018.
Yeah.
And so we got introduced this weekend to your business location.
Yeah, our office. Our office in Bogota.
Okay. So the operations and the environs, and we get a sense of the way things work here in Bogota. And it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So we flew in on a Thursday night.
Right.
We checked out the business.
On Friday.
That's right. And since then, we've been getting a taste of the life of Nico and Granger in Bogota.
Exactly. And it started with a literal taste because, of course, the first thing we did was we went to lunch. Mm-hmm. And we got to lunch. It was great because we got to go to a place that Granger and Nico go to on a regular basis. How often do you go to this place?
About every day when we're working, Monday
and
through
the name
Friday.
Of the place is what?
Papadillo.
So tell us a little bit about Papadillo. We thought we had a great meal there.
No, Papadillo is really great because it's Colombian food, but it's mostly from La Costa, so the coast of Colombia. It has some sweet drinks, which is the water that they would serve there, which also has like canela and panela. The food is, they have fish there, and they have the pechuga, which G likes to get, and carne desmechada, which is pulled pork. And a lot of the times, if you get there a little bit too late, all the good stuff is gone.
So you come, they have limited offerings.
Right, yep. Yeah.
And you get kind of a full meal.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It costs next night. It's a very small place. Mm-hmm. Let's say it's not upscale. You get to see the sauces made, for lack of a better term.
Well, they're not making sauces.
They're not making sauces, right. Though. And yes, it is inexpensive.
So, but what's included in the meal? You get a soup.
You get soup or fruit if you want that instead.
Right.
You get an entree,
right? Mm-hmm. Either fish or meat, and you get your rice or coconut rice,
mm-hmm.
and you probably get a little plantain besides, and it costs about $3 or maybe $3.50, which is here, 10,000 pesos.
Lunch spot.
Yeah.
And there are many like this.
A local lunch spot for people at work.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that was fun.
Yeah.
We had a really fun lunch there.
Right. And then, of course, on our travels, we broke away from business because we had had enough business just by
Nico
seeing.
Nico and Granger had to go back to business.
And we went to see
Monserrate,
which was extremely impressive. Tamsin, you probably can better describe Monserrate than I can.
Well, we... how would you describe it? It's a high point.
Yeah, Monserrate is definitely higher than the rest of the city. Most people sell it to other people by saying that it's like a pilgrimage. You know, you walk up it, you have this idea of like finding Jesus or finding God when you get to the top.
There's a church at the top.
There's a church at the
top.
It's a
high point. You take a cable car
or a train.
Or a funicular, mm-hmm. a train,
or you walk up.
We don't know those people.
People walk up on their knees sometimes.
Oh,
yep.
Yeah,
right.
No, yes.
People run up. You yes. guys have run up, yes. right?
No, we walked.
You walked.
Okay. Yeah, let me tell you something. It was enough taking the cable car.
How many thousand?
Oh, I don't know the answer. I know the answer to that.
Yeah,
it's Bogota is generally speaking 8,500 feet in terms of elevation, which mm-hmm. is a factor. And this is 10,500 feet in terms of elevation. And when they made that announcement in the cable car on the way up, I said to myself, this is smart. This is our first day in Colombia. Let's get higher. Because right now I'm breathing relatively easily. But I bet after this cable car trip, I won't be able to do anything but gasp for air. And sure enough, I was right. So we got out of the cable car. And the first thing they say is, well, you just walk up here and say, oh, stairs? We're going to take stairs? And on top of that, it was cold.
Yeah, I have to mention one more thing about Monserrate, and that's it. If you decide to walk up and you're part of a couple, there's two of you who are together romantically, you are supposed to break up before you walk up because supposedly there's a curse, and if you're in a relationship and you climb it together, by the time you get to the top, you will have broken up.
Can I explain the curse?
Yes.
Okay. Even if you're married to someone for, I don't know, let's pull a number out of the air, 30 years, 35 years, if you were to walk up that hill together with that elevation, believe me, you'll be screaming at each other by the time you get to the top. So it's not an easy curse to understand, and not a hard curse to understand. I get it completely. But it was beautiful. It was beautiful. What a view.
Well, you see all of Bogota, And Bogota is a huge city.
And we were up there on a beautiful day.
Yeah, we were up there on a beautiful day. But it was super cold because you're so high up.
Right.
And
we stumbled around and got ourselves a cocoa tea, which is what you do. Coca tea, which is, maybe you can, it's coca leaves.
Yeah, it's coca leaves. Yeah. And they put some panela in it. Panela is just like the sugar, darker sugar that they use here.
As close as we can come to cocaine. And it's supposed to help with the elevation and really anything else that's on your mind. And
they also have, so they have some restaurants up there, some of them quite nice.
Right.
And snack bars and, you know, little souvenir stand kind of things.
Right.
But mainly it's about the view, and it's beautiful.
It was beautiful there. It was just breathtaking, literally and figuratively.
So it was a physical experience and...
it's a pilgrimage.
It was a pilgrimage in many ways, even though not necessarily religious for us.
Not for us.
And then you have to fight your way down.
Well, that's another experience.
You know, I will say one thing. Since we've been in Colombia, we've been on a lot of lines.
Starting with customs, which was almost 2 hours.
And so we did have a big excitement getting down off of the mountain.
Yes, we took the train instead of the cable car because they helpfully directed everyone in the cable car line, which was long.
And it's a very steep train line. It's crazy.
It's very steep.
But we did manage to get down.
Yeah.
And
in about 8 seconds, I think.
But then we couldn't get home.
Well, that's there was too much traffic. That's an Uber issue. But we got
home. It was a traffic issue.
Bogota traffic.
We had ordered an Uber and our Uber guy could not get
to us. Well, if you ever have the Uber experience, some people may have had this, where the waiting time for the Uber car just gets longer. So they click in at 8, and you wait 2 minutes, and now it's 10. And you say, well, I thought it worked the other way. And then in a few more minutes, it's 12. And you say, something's not going to work here.
Eventually the Uber guy canceled on us.
Yes. Well, that's it.
But we eventually got back to our hotel.
We took a cab. And we got back, and then we went out to dinner with Granger and Nico to an Indian restaurant named...
Indian Gourmet.
Okay. Not the most exciting name, perhaps.
Wait a minute. I didn't get that.
India Gourmet. Right. Mm-hmm. And but it was a nice small Indian restaurant, very nice, sort of unpretentious, and they had a lot of fine Indian food, and we enjoyed it a great deal, and God knows we were hungry.
And I brought up while we were there that early in our travels we poo-pooed the idea of having ethnic foods not from the country you're visiting.
That's a mistake.
Really, as it turns out, you can have some fun food experiences by whatever. But we have had traditional Colombian food.
Well, we had that for lunch.
We've made a point of having that. Yeah. But we've also had some good other culinary experiences.
So the next day, another adventure, because that's the way we roll. And this was a chance. I don't know about you. I've always wanted to see a salt mine. And not only that, a salt mine with religious significance, because the pilgrimage on the previous day wasn't enough for me. And perhaps someone can better explain
this. Well, we went to the Salt Cathedral of Zipaquirá. Mm-hmm. Is that how you say it?
Zipaquirá.
Yeah. And
that's right. Let me just say, Salt Cathedral. That's what the woman said. A salt cathedral.
Yeah.
So it was a salt mine, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and it was a salt mine for a long time. It mm-hmm. was originally in that area. The local natives had made use of the salt, and then eventually when the Spanish came over, it was exploited more until it was industrialized in the 1900s.
Right, and so trying to make use of this dugout salt empty space,
right?
They crafted a cathedral.
Yes, originally using the backstory that the workers had their own little place to pray, it got built into a tourist attraction after they were no longer mining there, and then got remodeled in the 90s to make an even bigger tourist attraction. And now it's one of the big selling points, or not the big selling points, one of the big tourist attractions near Bogota.
Really?
Yeah, in Colombia.
And again, it's kind of touted as making a pilgrimage. Right. You know, it's a religious experience. You walk 180 meters down into the old mine, and there are various representations. There are abstract carvings representing the, how do you say it in Spanish? Via... What? Cruces?
Oh, Los Cruces.
Los Cruces. You know, yeah. The Stations of the Cross. Yeah. Very abstract, very modern, actually. Tucked into little...
alcoves.
Alcoves that used to be sections of the mine. Okay?
Yeah, I think, like, quite literally, it's a big cross at every Station of the Cross. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to the audio tour, your tour guide, then they describe what was going on in the... You know, the story of Jesus.
And what I would describe as Lord the Tale.
And but anyway, but the thing is, I mean, you can literally lick the walls and they're salty.
Yeah.
Not that you would.
You are in a salt mine.
Yeah,
and,
no, look.
And I never really thought about, I mean, we've always joked about, you know, working in the salt mines, back, you know, back to the salt mines.
Who knew that that was a bad job to have?
No, but it really brings it home. Yes. When you're, especially if you're a little claustrophobic like me.
It was dark and the salt is hard.
So you
need a pickaxe.
And you go down, 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 down until you come to a big open area, the nave, the, you know, with pews, mm-hmm. etc. It was something.
It was something. That's for sure. And but when you say down, 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 let me just put this in altitude context. Before you go down, 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 you go up, 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 because mm-hmm. you have to drive up. Again, another chance to gain elevation in Bogota because we haven't been high enough. So it's just one of the things that we ought to mention is to get there, you're going all the way up in elevation. It's a fairly long ride. And of course, it's made even longer by the incredible choking traffic of Bogota. I'll just mention one thing about traffic, which is not interesting, but this. The traffic is so bad on these roads and their highways that there are people in the middle of the roads selling things.
Selling snacks.
Selling
while you're in traffic.
Selling snacks, I can understand.
Not even, you're not at stoplights.
No, no.
The middle of the road. So slow.
The middle of the road.
People can sell things.
It's a selling opportunity.
Plus, when you come to a toll booth,
yeah.
To some extent, there are toll takers who run out into the crowd.
Yeah, to take the money.
I know, and take the money.
Yes.
Before you even get to the toll booth.
But to me, I still can't get the vendors.
It's crazy.
It's one thing that they're selling snacks, they're cotton candy, but they're selling they were selling kites.
They're selling board games.
Board games. Yeah. I mean, you're stuck in traffic for hours and people say, you know what we could use? We could use a kite. Anybody selling a kite? Is this like seventh floor or something like that? And it's crazy. And when I was talking to someone later, we said, well, traffic's bad everywhere. You're from the New York area, you know traffic. Well, let me say something about that. I understand traffic's bad on the BQE, which is an unpleasant road, or even the Long Island Expressway, but there's no one standing in the middle of the road. And you know why? Because you'd be killed. Because sometimes it does move. These roads in Bogota never move. The traffic never moves.
But Nico tells the story that not only can you get a board game if you want it, but you can say to the board game guy, no, I don't need a board game. But where's the coffee guy?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, people will shout to each other. And, you know, that guy will run over to
you.
You
can not only buy a board game in traffic, you can play a board game for the guy who sells the game.
So anyway.
The traffic's unbelievable.
Lots of traffic.
All right. So we came back.
Go down, down, down into the mine.
So it got down the mine and came up and I was done with the mine. Is there more to say about the
Well, it's kind of funny. Once you get down there, they also have a kind of a mall area.
Yeah.
And they have... quite a lot of souvenirs. Yeah. They have a little snack area.
Our Christmas shopping is finished.
They have a theater with a wonderful film about the history of salt.
Okay. Let me just say something about that. Three out of the four people here fell asleep during the film, but I yield the floor to the one person who did not.
If you are not film aficionados, it was excellent. The animation, I thought, was adorable. They had Hal, the rock guy.
He's like a Transformer character.
Yeah.
But he was made of rocks, explaining the geology to us. And it was really a treat.
Yeah, it was great.
I was excited to sit down.
It was nice to sit down. That's nice to take a little nap.
And it was 3D. We had 3D glasses.
Yeah. A lot of the trip has
been
3D.
It was like Hal was in the room with us.
If only. So in any event, so we got back home. Oh, I shouldn't say it. We stopped for lunch on the way back, and that's an event. Does anybody know the name of that restaurant? I don't know the name.
I didn't catch the name.
But it was in a small town. Maybe we know the name of the small town.
It was in Zipaquirá.
Yeah.
And that was fascinating in and of itself.
Whoa. When we were going through the town to get to the Salt Cathedral, they actually, people run up with plates of grilled meats and shove them into your car to give you samples.
Well, yes.
So that you will come back to their restaurant.
Everyone knows
and
that.
As you walk by, all these restaurants have these big
rotisserie type pits.
Yeah, they have
grilling
these,
pits.
Big iron bars.
But they're glass and closed. They're glass and closed.
And all these meats hanging over the coals.
That's the decor. You see the meats.
One of them,
the
they had a big dog guarding the grilled meats.
Thank goodness. So in any event, we got to go to one of these places on the way back. And that's what we had two things. We had the grilled meats. They came up with this big groaning board of the grilled meats, which is exciting and interesting and tastes good. And they also had these soups, like these yucca soups or whatever. And I think...
Nico, what was the soup you said? Yucca.
Yeah, did I say yucca?
He said yucky
soup.
Said yucky. They didn't have yucky soup. Yeah. But what was the soup you had, the traditional Colombian soup?
So that's ajiaco. That's the one you had half of,
the
too.
The ajiaco, yeah.
Ajiaco.
I had about a third of it. I didn't have half of it. Okay, yeah.
So the special thing about ajiaco is that it needs a special herb called huasca. Huasca. So the huasca...
Wait a minute, one person at a time. Called what?
Huasca.
Huasca.
Yeah.
So huasca, you put it in there, but in the soup it has pulled chicken, yuca, potatoes, corn, and
they bring it to you with
aguacate, a rice, what are those things? Capers
and sour cream.
And sour cream.
And you stir these
and you put everything into the soup. Yeah.
And it was good. It was excellent.
Yeah. I love that soup.
Yeah,
so
it was a great meal. And
you guys had the picao colombiano, and it has a bunch of different meats, the morcilla, the sausages, yuca.
Yeah, it had pork, it had beef, it had chicken, it had sausages, you're right. And then afterwards we went to the town square. It's a very, very old town, old town, and dates from, 16th century.
Well, I think the Spanish town does, but I think it's a little bit less clear how long with the, whatever you want to call it, the settlement or town of Native Americans extends back to. Apparently that's one of the oldest locations.
Pre-Columbian,
in South
definitely.
America.
Yeah,
because of the salt mine, because the salt was so valuable in ancient times, but just valuable in the old world in general. There was a town of this elevation, which is pretty unusual, I guess. And this is really, really an old community.
But salt was so important.
Yeah.
It was, equal in value to gold to some extent. Our guide said to me that the word salary comes from how the workers were paid in salt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which was kind of interesting. And what was the street treat that people were eating? Obleda.
Mm-hmm.
And explain what that is, Nico.
Obleda is two very thin wafers, and in between you put arequipe or cheese or different mermeladas.
So arequipe is?
Is kind of like a caramel sauce, basically.
Yeah.
Butterscotch,
and,
you say sometimes.
Yeah, it's between those two, yeah.
And so that they heat it up a little bit?
No, arequipe is creamy. It's kind of like Nutella consistency.
So they take the thin wafers, and they're about 6 inches in diameter, 5 or 6 inches in diameter.
More.
They're really quite large.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you have to eat them right away because they're very drippy.
You want it crispy. So.
Yeah. Everybody was, people were eating that in the town square. Also, there was a guy with a spirulator. And a green mango.
Mm-hmm.
And cutting those into ribbons and putting them in a little cup and then having all kinds of toppings for that.
And the genius of both of those is that they don't need any refrigeration. So what you have are these carts which are selling these treats, but they don't have to have any kind of contraption that keeps things cold. And especially the mango thing is being sold. Kids are lining up as if they're getting ice cream.
Yeah.
Right? And you have this guy with the simplest cart in the world in the middle of the square, and he's working at it, delivering, and these kids are just, you know, put on more sprinkles or something like that.
Yeah.
And he's doing it without any refrigeration at all.
Yeah.
So it's genius.
Well, those people are descended from, I mean, I don't know if those are the same people, like descended from the people like thousands of years ago. This town basically has been having food without refrigeration next to the salt, you know, for like 2,500 years.
You know, one thing we didn't go into at the Salt Cathedral?
What?
The Brine Museum. Which, you know, I mean, that's interesting. Probably more interesting to me than the Gold Museum in the middle of Bogota. So next time.
Next time.
Anxious to learn more about brine. But these are the people who would know, right?
So in any event, so that was fascinating. And we got back in the van and got back to town and did a little better traffic-wise. And you would have thought that given the big meal we just had that it would be done for the day, but you'd be wrong. So we just sort of relaxed and sort of reassembled ourselves and then got back together for a little snack in the evening at a big square, which is called...
Not a square, kind of an area.
What's it called?
Zona T.
Okay, Zona T.
With gazillions of restaurants, pubs.
And pumping music, you know, very lively, ton of people, ton of sound.
Mostly younger people, I would say.
Well, yeah, but I don't know. It was a range. We were there, and there was a lot of outdoor seating. And we actually took advantage of the outdoor seating at one place. I don't remember what it was called. I know Cerveza was a big thing in the title.
It was just called Cerveceria.
Well, that's a catchy enough name for me, which, of course, which means beer, for those of us who are not sure. And we got ourselves at an outdoor table, and we got ourselves a 40-ounce pitcher of Colombian black lager. And we got the largest portion of
super nachos
ever seen.
I don't know. I couldn't quite understand the waiter's approach, but we ordered the super nachos, and he looked at us. He said, "You understand in Spanish, of course. You understand that this is a huge thing, as if, and there's four of us, and it costs $13." And I'm saying to myself, "Really? He's talking us out of the super nachos? Well, what's going on?" And of course, when he brought it, it was. Overwhelming. It was unseemly. It was really weird. And same time, well, who is this for? It's for groups of 12? I mean, what's going on? But in any event, so we were very happy eating the super nachos, drinking the beer on the porch of the Cerveza, surveying the scene. And that was very nice last night.
Right.
And we had gelato.
Oh, we had terrific gelato.
We had gelato. Airport, that's right. It's that kind of square. It was a lot of fun. And then we got back and we had today. And today we had a long walk in the city in which we got to observe an event where they close the streets and they do biking. What's that called?
Ciclovía.
Okay, Ciclovía it is. And we got to see some Colombian weather finally. We were told when we got here that it rains every day, and we said, that's funny because it's been sunny the whole time. And it did rain this morning. Now, one thing that's interesting, I think I heard, maybe from you guys probably, is that it's so temperate here that the temperature pretty much ranges, you know, it's in the 50s, 60s, maybe the 70s, but it's never terribly hot. It's never terribly cold.
Yeah, except for like really high-priced office buildings, you never see air conditioning or heaters or radiators.
Well, that's bizarre. I mean, I'll take you at your word, but that's a big savings. And it's interesting. It's also an attractive aspect of the area. That you can count on that kind of weather.
Yeah, businesses don't have to spend anything on their energy bill, basically.
Wow.
Just the light.
Right. And then, of course, for lunch, we returned to the scene of the crime. We went back to that same area.
Zona T.
And we hit up a Mexican restaurant, and we did some damage there. And now we're winding down.
Right. So it's been quite a big excitement.
Yes, and we're getting ready. We're flying out this evening. That's Tamsin and me. But you two guys are going to be here minding the store.
All right. So any last words about your adventures thus far in Bogota?
Well, first, it was very nice for you to visit us. So thank you for visiting us. And also, like I'm a Nico, it's been a very positive experience for me trying out just a city I'd never lived in before.
What do you mean you don't know about Nico?
Well, I'm just saying you have lived here before. You've lived here before for the summer. So, much
so it's a different experience for you. Okay. And none of this could have happened. Bogota, Dev, or the visit of Dan and Tamsin could not have happened without Nico's tremendous language skills, which has made everything more doable.
Yeah, if I were I would not walk up that hill together by the cable car because you may not be ready for that. Oh, you did that?
We already did.
Big mistake. So in any event, so that sort of ties it up for this segment. But we'll continue with the rest of the podcast on Tamsin and Dan.
Read the paper.
Yes, thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Hasta luego.
Wait just a doggone minute here. There's more to this podcast.
Yes, we're back in the USA.
Yes, not only did we go to Bogota,
but we had
in the past week, we also went to Nueva York.
Yes, we also went to 54 Below to see Melissa Errico. 54 Below, as we've mentioned before, is a place we go to see some cabaret acts. We've gone two or three times now. This might be the third, and we kind of enjoy it.
We do enjoy it. We had a terrific time, and we sat next to some very nice people, Howard and Eleanor. You see, you buy seats at tables.
That's right.
But you may end up sharing a table.
They don't tell you
with
that.
Someone you don't know.
So we're in a booth. They say, oh, you get a booth. But they don't tell you you're sharing the booth. And thankfully, we had a very nice couple who we were sitting with because you're in there, you know, pretty close. And the whole area is kind of close, which is good. It's a very intimate performance when you go to,
right.
to 54 Below.
Right.
I can't estimate how many people in the room. Maybe it's 60. I don't know. But you're really about 10, 12, 20 feet from the performer.
It's a very private concert.
Yeah, it's a
whole cabaret style is just amazing.
And, you know, I don't know how the economics work, and maybe they don't, but it's a very different experience from being
in a theater. I assume they don't, because cabarets are dying. There are very few left.
Well, they sell you dinner.
They're very expensive.
Yeah.
And even Howard and Eleanor remarked that younger people aren't coming. These are,
this kind of format is
going to disappear.
Well, that's true, but they're not coming to a lot of plays also. But in any event, they were very familiar with 54 Below. They'd gone a number of times. They knew the names of the waitstaff, and they live in Manhattan, and they can do this kind of thing. And
anytime they want.
Apparently. In any event. Melissa Errico was the attraction. Melissa Errico, you know, first came to my attention.
Did you mention
what?
Ryan Silverman?
I'm going to get to him.
Like it was only Melissa.
We came to see Melissa Errico. She was accompanied by a fellow named Ryan Silverman.
She wasn't accompanied.
It was a two-person act. A two-hander, yes. But Melissa Errico first became aware of her, at least I did, in a performance that we missed. We had started going encores about the second year, but in the first year, there was a much acclaimed production of something called One Touch of Venus, in which she sang a song called That's Him. And she sang that again. It's Kurt Weill's song. She sang that again last week, and it's a great song, but she got quite a bit of publicity for that. And she's been in things like My Fair Lady. She was in a production of Passion, which she talked about at Classic Stage Company, giving them another plug. She's been in a couple of productions of Finian's Rainbow. She is currently in a production of On a Clear Day You Can See Forever, which is that also at the Irish Repertory Theater? I think it is.
What do you mean also?
Phineas Rainbow was at the Irish Repertory Theater, too.
Oh, I thought that was Encores.
No, that was we saw Kate Baldwin in Phineas Rainbow. We didn't see her.
Oh.
But in any event, and On a Clear Day got a pretty decent review, though everyone always describes that show as, quote, problematic. But putting that aside, she's a wonderful singer. And we enjoyed seeing her a great deal. And she was accompanied. Let's go to it. Not accompanied. Two-person act. The other person, Ryan Silverman. Ryan Silverman had performed with her a number of times. He was in the Passion production I mentioned. He was in Finian's Rainbow with Melissa Errico. He was in Sideshow, the production we saw of Sideshow.
Right.
In a very main part.
He's a very attractive, you know, good-looking matinee idol kind of guy with a big
tenor, I think.
Voice.
When you say it's a tenor?
What do I know? I don't know anything about music.
He doesn't have a deep voice. He has
a very strong voice.
Very strong voice. Very strong tenor. Wonderful voice. And the two of them were wonderful together. And so, and the funny story that I had read about Melissa Erica, first of all, let me just say that she was kind of wacky. I should continue that thought. She was, it's comic, you know, it was a lot of a great variety of songs, a couple of your favorites. It's not often that you see someone perform a Call the Wind Mariah on a stage like that, which she did.
Well, he sang that.
Oh, that's right. He sang that. What was the song that she sang that you also thought was unusual? What, the Ethel Merman song.
I hear singing when there's no one there.
Exactly. They did that duet. And you also don't hear that very
spring, we're just in love. Well, the setup was that they were singing about love.
Love, yeah.
About love working out, not working out, no, complications.
It was a great act.
Yeah.
And it was a great evening. And one funny story that I saw in the paper about her, we knew that she's married to Patrick McEnroe, John McEnroe, the tennis champion's younger brother. And what I didn't realize about her, well, number one, she, like you, Tamsin, was an art history major in college. In her case, she went to Yale. John went to Stanford. But the interesting thing is they knew each other as children, as very young children. They went to, he was a few years older, but best friends with her older brother.
Uh-huh.
And then they didn't see each other for years. Then they reconnected. And yet they still remember the names of each other's pets, dogs, whatever. So they were pretty tight.
Where did they grow up?
Well, he grew up in Douglastown, and she grew up in Manhasset, but they both moved around a little bit, too. Okay. And they went to a private school, so mm-hmm. That's why they ended up in the same school. But it's just funny, it's one of those couples that knew each other growing up and then reconnected.
All right, enough romance.
Yes, enough romance. Anyway, that was a great evening. That was a lot of fun. And we just have a few items that we wanted to talk about. In the paper, I know you were very impressed with LeBron James' bicycle skills.
Well, I guess there's been articles about him riding his bike.
Yeah.
He's apparently famous for occasionally riding his bike to work. That is, to the basketball.
Really? In Cleveland?
No. I think he's done it. He might have done it a couple of times in Cleveland, but I know he did it in Miami.
Yeah, Miami, right.
And
yeah.
So anyway, Jason Gay wrote an article, the LeBron James interview about bicycles,
right,
in the Wall Street Journal. And I guess Gay is a bicycle geek himself,
okay,
wild about bikes, and so he was anxious to talk to LeBron about it. LeBron just opened this school in Akron, the I Promise School,
mm-hmm,
where he has committed to a full scholarship to the University at Akron for anybody who graduates through high school, mm-hmm, there. Anyway, and something else he has promised is he's promised every student there a bicycle and a helmet. And he reflected a little bit about how growing up, bicycles meant freedom to him. He could get around. Mm-hmm. He could go places. And he wants to give that,
yeah,
to others. Well, and he participates in various, like bikeathon things. He's knowledgeable. Now, he doesn't use clipless pedals.
Right.
And he basically rides a mountain bike usually, mm-hmm, occasionally a hybrid. Okay, Gay was a little bit disappointed in his stable, so to speak, and ran off a list of bikes LeBron might want to consider.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he also reflected on, that thing they say, the how many bikes should any cyclist own?
No, I don't know.
N plus one.
Meaning?
N meaning referring to the bikes you have now plus the one you're going to get.
Oh, I see. So, well, he can afford it, although I don't see him riding the bike in L.A. But
no, he was kind of musing on that.
Yeah.
The highways, the traffic, that would be something, that would be a challenge. But he did mention, this is LeBron, that he knows that there is a great, great beach bike path in Santa Monica.
Well, did he?
Yeah. So maybe Zeke will run into him on the Santa Monica.
That'll be quite a collision.
Yeah.
We were on that path. Exactly right. Well, I'm glad. Yeah, I did read a little bit about
it. So LeBron, if you're listening,
yeah,
we can recommend that to you.
I know. I did read that he said that getting on a bike really opened up worlds to him. He met kids from other neighborhoods. He met kids from other backgrounds, other races, and he found it very easy to make friends. I would just add that when you're the biggest, strongest guy in town and the best basketball player, that too helps you make friends, quite apart from the bicycle. But in any event, he had a good experience, and I'm glad he's giving the bicycles away.
It's intimidating to see a picture of him on a bike.
Yeah.
He's so much bigger than any bike.
Let me tell you something. If I was the Los Angeles Lakers and paying him $16 million a year, I wouldn't want to see him get clip-lips pedals. I think we leave it the program the way it is. So my sports story this week is a little bit in the past. But interesting, and it's about a sport you know more about than I do, which is ice hockey, since you played ice hockey. It's about Stan Mikita. And do you remember that name, Stan Mikita?
Only barely. Okay. You know, I'm not much of an ice hockey fan. I'm not knowledgeable.
I see.
I was just somebody who played a little.
All right. Well, he was a big star for the Chicago Blackhawks in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And cover of Sports Illustrated. A most valuable player, often the winner of the Lady Byng Trophy, which is the trophy they give to the greatest sportsman in the NHL, which seems like a contradiction in terms. But that he would win that regularly. And he was a little guy.
Does that mean good behavior?
Yeah, good behavior. Okay. Yeah. But the funny thing, there's a couple of things I didn't know about him I found fascinating. First of all, his name was not Stan Mikita growing up. And he was not Canadian, like everyone else in the NHL. His name was Stanislav Gvoth, G-V-O-T-H. Mm-hmm. And he was born in Czechoslovakia.
Mm-hmm.
And his parents didn't have very much money. And just before Christmas in 1948, an aunt and uncle, Joe and Anna Mikita, who had immigrated to Ontario, Canada, visited Stanislav's family in Czechoslovakia, and his father, Stanislav's father, decided that there was so little opportunity in Czechoslovakia, particularly given the dominance of the Soviet Union, that they sent their 8-year-old son, Stanislav, back with the Mikitas to Canada,
mm-hmm.
with the hope that he'd have a better life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he got to Canada. And as an 8-year-old, he took up hockey.
And that's how he got the name.
Stan from Stanislav and Mikita from the family that took him in.
Not from the drill.
No, not from the Mikita drill. No. Unlike rumor. So in any event, so that's his background. So he was a Czechoslovakian player in the NHL. But beyond that, this is what I found really fascinating. And that is Stan Mikita invented the curved hockey stick. The curved blade.
Uh-huh.
During a practice in the mid-60s, as Mikita told it, he accidentally bent the blade of his stick. He continued to use it that day and found that his shots were diving and had greater velocity than sticks with customary straight blades. And he began fashioning a curve on all his blades with a heating process.
Mm-hmm.
And then he told his buddy, his teammate Bobby Hull, about it.
Uh-huh.
Bobby Hull being the most famous player in the NHL at the time with the great
slap shot. That name I know.
And Hull had a 100-mile-per-hour slap shot.
Mm-hmm.
With a straight stick, but when he used it with a curved stick, it rose.
Mm-hmm.
And so in practice, they showed up with these curved sticks, and they had an all-star goalie, a fellow named Glenn Hall. And they started shooting these pucks at Glenn Hall, and he left practice. He went to the showers, he got dressed, he said, "I'm not coming back as long as they have those sticks." And that's how they knew they had something.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so the curved stick is a staple of the National Hockey League.
Right.
Did you guys use curved sticks in your game?
Yeah, sure.
But I
wasn't playing in the 60s.
No, of course not.
Then. Okay.
But you were playing collegiate hockey for Princeton. You used curved sticks. I thought you weren't allowed to lift the puck. That's what I remember.
Yeah.
No, yeah. Even
the
if
girls
could. Even if you could.
Yeah.
All right. But the curved stick is, you know, it's amazing that was created by accident by Stan Mikita.
All right. Thank you, Stan.
Okay.
All right. Now, here we go. It's been a while, but we have more bird sex.
Yeah, more bird
now,
sex.
Now, brace yourselves.
Yeah, I'm
might
braced.
Be time to send the children to the kitchen for a snack.
Yeah.
Because the title of this article from the New York Times is, "Why Are Some Crows Committing Acts of Necrophilia?" "It's certainly very surprising to me," said the researcher, who observed the birds' strange behaviors when presented with crow cadavers. And
I'm not saying anything. I'm just listening. Go ahead.
The setting was romantic enough. Sunny spring day, a cherry tree blossoming a vivid pink. One party, the suitor, was dark, fetching, amorous. But the other party lay there like a corpse. It was, in fact, a corpse. And so this is the story of Kaylee Swift, a doctoral candidate at the University of Washington who studies crows. And she was demonstrating one of her experiments for a film crew. She had left to the side a stuffed crow on the ground, and another crow swooped down, crouching low, trying to have intercourse with the stuffed crow. And so this was all very confusing because there's the whole story about crows, when they see other dead crows, they get the hell out of there, because it probably means a predator is right around. And so she spends the next 3 years doing studies, experiments on crows with dead crows, and, right, and seeing what happens. And so among the hundreds of crows observed during the study, the majority merely cawed loudly and dive-bombed at the corpse without touching it. But 24% of the winged subjects pecked, pulled, or dismembered the bodies, and in 4% of the encounters observed, crows attempted copulation.
Well, it's 4% of every species is going to be out of its bird, right? It's going
to
be
completely out. So they're trying to figure out why this happens.
Yeah.
And Kevin McGowan, professor at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, said... he hadn't witnessed any necrophilia in his observation of crows, but he suspects that overcharged hormones are largely at play. There's a huge amount of growth and disappearance of bird gonads during the off-breeding season, Dr. McGowan said, referring to the way bird testes may expand or shrink depending on the time of year. That affects the hormones circulating in its system and the reaction to the stimuli the crow encounters. So it's not surprising that you would see incidental sexual behavior pretty much only in the breeding season. So it just kind of says to you that because of these hormonal, when these hormonal swings are going on, anything could happen. Yeah. I think we already knew that, right?
Yeah, I'm surprised it's only 4%. It shows how conservative the crows really are.
Some crows may be incapable of umpiring their own responses to stimuli, she suggests, during this period. So they engage in them all.
Oh, God. All right, so that's a lovely story. That's super. All right, so the respond to that.
Crows are super smart, though.
Are they?
Crows are the smartest birds, yeah.
96% of them, maybe. So the final story...
Even the smart crows have hormones, Dan.
Yeah, I know, but they are directing them in the right path. In any event, there was a good article called "Americans Are Terrible at Small Talk" by a woman named Maeve Higgins, who is Irish, and her observation, as she puts it, says, "In the 4 years I've lived in the United States, I have grown used to excruciatingly sincere exchanges. Americans are good at a great many things, but they struggle with small talk." And she writes a piece in which she says there's something about small talk that Americans don't get. They just open up. They either say nothing, they ignore you, or they open up completely. And when asked the most innocent question, they start telling you their innermost
story.
Secrets.
Yeah, yeah.
And it misses the value of small talk. You can't have a useful, comfortable exchange with people unless they're willing to talk about the donut they just ate, or the color of the sky today, or how much it rained yesterday. And what she calls small talk, which she finds highly valuable. She says, when you talk about something like that, again, these are her words, you may not find out where someone works or who they know or how their relationship is with their family, but you'll get some idea of that odd-shaped part of a human being that's invisible to the eye and impossible to articulate. What a seemingly meaningless exchange means is we can relax. the person we're inches away from for the afternoon is not dangerous. At the end of the trip, we'll nod and smile, and I won't be left wondering why his father said that one thing in 1994 that meant he never had the confidence to pursue a career in architecture. So, you know, I think she has a point.
Part of the deal that she sort of points out is that at this point, we just don't even mess with small talk. We go right to the phone.
Right.
Everybody just dives their head into the smoke.
Well, no, it's one of two things. I think what she's saying, there's no middle ground. Like, there's no middle wardrobe. Either you're dealing with people who won't talk to you, won't look at you, engage with their phone, look at their shoes, whatever. Mm-hmm. Or if they're going to talk to you, they're going to talk about something substantive. They're going to talk about what's on their mind. They're going to feel that they have to overshare. And what she's saying, there's something in between. And
there's a value to it.
And there's a value to it, that you get a sense of people. People don't feel threatened. The conversation continues. And you know, we had sort of that experience this week. I mean, we met a very nice couple at 54 Below. And, you know, we had a very good time with them. We learned something from them about their experience at 54 Below, but just talking casually about things. We also had the experience in Bogota, going back to the first half of this piece, where this is a wild coincidence. We went on that trip to the salt mines.
Yes.
Great trip to the salt mines. And it's a very small group. It was like about 8 people or 9 people. And we show up to get into the van together that we're all stuffed in traffic. And I turned to you as soon as we get out and said, those are the people who sat next to us on the airplane to Bogota. And they were.
Right.
What are the odds of that? And
chit-chat ensued.
Yes. And we talked about it. And it was a wonderful story, really. I mean, the father of the family started telling us about this. It was their fourth trip to Bogota.
Yeah.
And he explained that...
You know, now you're veering away from the small talk.
Okay.
Okay, that wasn't small talk.
That wasn't small talk. It got a little more substantive.
Yeah.
But we certainly had a good time with them.
Yes.
And that's part of the deal with these trips. You get something out of those conversations, even if you don't find people's innermost secrets. So, you know, it's a good thing to have. So in any event, work on your small talk.
I'm working on it.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know if John Raitt would approve.
Well, that's a reference to the pajama game. And don't tell anybody that crow story again. That's not small talk. That's, you know, that's for the second date. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. All right. And that's all we have until next time at...
Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper.
Thanks.
I don't want to talk small talk now that I'm alone with you. I don't want to talk small talk. We've got bigger things to do. Let's not talk of the weather or the fashions for the fall. Why don't you stop all this small talk? I've got something better for your lips to do, and that takes no talk at all.
I gotta buy me a dressy dress. The one that I have is such a mess.
Small talk.
Who will you vote for next election? How do you like the stamp collection?
Small talk. Read in a book the other day that halibut spawn in early May, and horses whinny and donkeys bray, and furthermore, the pygmy tribes in Africa may have a war.
No.
Yes, I don't want to talk small
talk. What do you think they charge for fruit now?
Now that I'm alone with you.
Got so a buck ain't worth a hoot now.
I don't want to talk small talk.
Read where the winters are getting milder.
We've got bigger things to
do. And that the teenage kids are wilder.
Let's not talk of the weather.
One of these days I'll paint the kitchen.
Or the fashions for the fall.
Get Pop to put a new light switch in.
Why don't you stop all this small talk?
Like I was saying,
I've got something better.
What I mean is,
for your lips
I was
to do.